You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. My name is Richard Bush. I'm the director of the Center for East Asia Policy Studies here at the Brookings Institution. And I'm really pleased to welcome you on what's a wonderful day for the Center and for Brookings. We are here today, as you know, to launch a new book by our colleague Maria Solis, who holds the Phil Knight Chair in Japan Studies. The title of the book is Dilemmas of a Trading Nation, Japan and the United States in the Evolving Asia-Pacific Order. I have to say, this happens to be, I think, the prettiest cover on a Brookings Institution press that I've ever seen, much prettier than any of my books. Maria came to Brookings from American University up the hill, where she taught for a number of years. She has her PhD from Harvard's government department. Maria's book is firmly in the tradition of objective, in-depth research, which is a bit of a short commodity in Washington these days. To my mind, it does two very important things. Lest we forget about TPP, Maria documents how Japan's commitments under TPP were a significant departure from its prior approach to the international trading system, and that was a good thing. Second, she explains clearly and comprehensively why an open trading system is one important ingredient to prosperity in America and around the world, and that's an important thing too. Maria is going to present the key ideas of her book, and then our good friend Wendy Cutler will provide some commentary. Wendy is the Vice President and Managing Director of the Asia Society's D.C. office, the Asia Society Policy Institute, she's doing an outstanding job building out Asia Society's presence in Washington, D.C. And as a long-ago employee of the Asia Society here in Washington, I can tell you that she's making good progress. A lot of you know that she joined ASPI after a long and distinguished career of almost three decades as a diplomat and negotiator in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. And among other things, in her long career, she was responsible for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, including the bilateral negotiations of with Japan. So she knows the commitments that Japan made. So without further ado, Maria.
Thank you very much, Richard, for that kind introduction and for all your support always. And thank you, Wendy, for sharing your thoughts on U.S.-Japan trade. I'm truly honored. And thank you, all of you, for being here today. For me, it is a very special day, so it's wonderful to have all of you here. They say that writing a book is a journey, but I should add that some journeys have more detours than others. And for me, the sharpest turn of events is the most recent one, when the United States government decided to leave the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. Suffice it to say that the book that I wrote is very different from the book that I intended to write. And the questions I asked changed over time, as well as my reflection as to how we got to the point we are in today and how should we move forward. My original set of questions was motivated by what I regarded as Japan's critical choices. Could Japan deploy a proactive trade policy to tackle many of the structural reforms that have hindered its competitiveness, or would the country remain shackled to its own domestic political constraints, unable to punch at its weight in international trade negotiations? Could the TPP negotiations recast the role of trade in the U.S.-Japan alliance? Would it be possible to find acceptable compromises on long, divisive market access issues and work together in drafting new rules on trade and investment, and at the same time capture the geopolitical benefits of anchoring the United States in the regional trade architecture at a time when Asia is experiencing a profound power shift with a growing rise of Chinese influence? These were my original questions. I thought they were good questions, but in the course of writing this book, the ground shifted, and shifted in very profound ways. Two electoral results last year sharply underscored the growing questioning of the merits of globalization: the Brexit vote in June and the American presidential election in November. So along the way, this book also became about the critical choices that the United States faces in the aftermath, especially in the aftermath of withdrawal from the TPP. Will the United States abdicate leadership in sustaining open trade policies as if it finds itself unable to sustain a consensus in favor of internationalism? What will be the economic and geopolitical fallout? How will the United States will recover from the loss of credibility of having walked away from a signed trade agreement? But more importantly, can we there hope for a correction course? Launching policies that address the growing income inequality and the hollowing out of the middle class that is eating up support for open economic policies in this country. So today, trade policy is front and center in the national conversations taking place in the United States and Japan about each country's desired future: economic renewal, a relaunched social compact, and projected international influence. And charting a path forward is difficult because I argue that if you think about what the essential goals of trade policy are, we're talking about economic competitiveness, social legitimacy, and political viability, and it's very hard to reconcile all of them. So the central argument of this book is that we're talking about, when countries are drafting trade policy, they're really thinking about confronting vexing trade-offs, dilemmas, I call them, defining dilemmas. So there are two such dilemmas that pervade the analysis of this book. The first one is that top-down decision-making may be necessary to push aside vested interest and implement needed economic reforms. But if trade policy becomes exclusionary, its legitimacy will be questioned. So there is a tension, if you will, between decisiveness and inclusiveness, between executive leadership and social inclusion. And that is a very difficult path that we have to confront as these countries make choices on trade policy. The second dilemma that I highlight in this book comes from the need to secure ratification of negotiated trade agreements. This may require making political accommodations in the sense of making sure that sensitive sectors remain off limits from tariff elimination, or extending subsidies to dying sectors. So this calls for political pragmatism, but it may also hinder the reform agenda. It may also cut back on the economic gains to be had from liberalization. So there is a tension here between pragmatism and ambition, between being a reformer and between being a political operative. So trade policy is crafted in a world of constraints. It is about balancing competing interests. It requires making hard choices. And these will be contested decisions because different groups in society will disagree about how to tackle those trade-offs. So it is with this keen realization, and believe me, I've lived with this topic for years, it is with this keen realization of how hard trade politics are that the book then fleshes out what I think are the central dilemmas confronting Japan and the United States. So let me briefly highlight what I see are these dilemmas and then my own thoughts as to how we move forward. I'll start with Japan. And the first dilemma or challenge that I would like to highlight is the search for decisiveness. In the post-war period, Japan emerged as an export powerhouse, and later on as one of the largest foreign direct investors. But it continued to play a passive role in international trade negotiations. It was a latecomer to the negotiation of preferential trade agreements, and one decade of trade diplomacy in this front only yielded very modest outcomes in terms of the size of the markets opened, the reach of the liberalization commitments. This was mostly a self-inflicted wound. The need to play defensive due to the clout of the agricultural lobby, which effectively vetoed negotiations with large agricultural exporters, and meant that none of Japan's free trade agreements passed the WTO standard of eliminating 90% of tariffs. This lackluster trading strategy was the result of a policy-making system that was ripe for indecisiveness. Top-down executive leadership was prevented by the cloud of vested interest who exercised influence in their respective policy areas, by intense bureaucratic sectionalism, and by the ability of policy tribes to shape policy inside the ruling party's policy-making body, de facto eclipsing the prime minister and the cabinet. When the Democratic Party of Japan interrupted decades of LDP rule in 2009, it tried to bring about executive leadership, and it tried to bring about TPP membership. And it failed on both counts. The DPJ remained bitterly divided on the merits of joining the trade agreement. Japanese ministries issued battling assessments of the economic consequence of TPP for the Japanese economy. And the agricultural lobby orchestrated a very effective anti-TPP campaign, a campaign like Japan had never seen before. It was a broader coalition across the political spectrum. It was not just only about agriculture. And it sent a message that resonated on the so-called TPP ghosts, outsized arguments about what would be the real influence on TPP on Japan, but one that in many ways was about signaling the potential danger that an unwanted economic and social transformation could be coming to Japan, the Americanization of Japan. This was not, therefore, a bright spot regarding the possibility of Japan joining the TPP. It eventually happened in 2013 because of political change inside Japan that enabled prime ministerial leadership. Prime Minister Abe was able to capitalize on high and sustained levels of public support to keep domestic challengers within his party at bay. And also, he capitalized on the decimation of the opposition camp after the DPJ was ousted from office. And this enabled him to break away from the cycle of one-year prime ministerships. Let's not forget that Japan had a revolving door of prime ministers, and every year we had to learn a different name for a different prime minister. And with these, he was able to bring then executive leadership and make the Kante, the prime minister office, the focal point of decision-making. And he was able to move away from the intense bureaucratic sectionalism that had hindered Japan's strategy by establishing a TPP headquarters that brought a far more coherent approach. Prime Minister Abe delivered on policy initiatives that until recently looked unobtainable for Japan. Participation in TPP and reform of the agricultural cooperative system. But make no mistake, there has been a heavy dose of political pragmatism to ensure reform efforts would not come at the expense of core political priorities, preserving party unity and recapturing the upper house in July 2013 to make sure that the legislative agenda would advance. So the Abe Kante is powerful, no question about it, but there have certainly been limits to executive leadership, taming the reach of reform. What we have witnessed, I would say, is a pattern of a negotiated decisiveness when it comes especially to the task of advancing economic reforms linked to the trade agenda. the agriculture lobby was able to weave its core preferences into adopted policies. One very clear example is that when Japanese trade negotiators finally made it to the table in the TPP talks in July 2013, they came with a very clear mandate. The five sacred commodities, the five sacred agricultural commodities, were to be off limits from full tariff elimination. And this then brings me to Japan's second major dilemma, second major challenge, and that is the long quest for economic reform. Structural reforms, unleashing the forces of productivity and innovation, are essential to Japan's economic future. And that is why TPP has been a central component of the Abenomics approach. But we should have realistic expectations when we think about what a trade agreement, as important as it is, can actually deliver. The TPP is not a magic bullet. Many of the reform areas that Japan must tackle are outside the scope of this trade agreement. Labor market reform, energy policy, or social security reform are examples of that. But participation in TPP did give Japan one very important asset, credibility. Credibility that this time the Prime Minister could embark in far more reaching reforms, and in doing so, confront vested interests to an extent that had not been done before. The United States and Japan engaged in tough market access negotiations on agriculture and automobiles, and launched the only set of parallel talks in the TPP on non-tariff measures to address long-standing bilateral issues. And I think Wendy here, of course, can attest to that, how tough these negotiations, how frustrating they were at many points in time. But at the end of the day, the United States and Japan were able to find compromises on old trade irritants, and they also worked together in crafting rules on trade and investment that would apply across the Asia-Pacific. In that sense, TPP negotiations marked a turning point in U.S.-Japan relations. Regarding negotiation outcomes, Japan for the first time met the WTO criteria of eliminating more than 90% of tariffs. And it also agreed to the highest level of service liberalization from any other trade negotiation that Japan had participated in. As part of the TPP reforms, Japan also incorporated corporate governance reforms and accepted more international standards than previously. But, and this is a big but, Japan's track record on agricultural liberalization once again left much to be desired. Agriculture continued to be the Achilles heel in Japanese trade strategy. So much so that despite the fact that Japan is the second largest economy in TPP, it came last in terms of the percentage of tariff lines to be eliminated at 95%. For the other TPP countries, this was in the range of 99 to 100%. And even though the political decision to defend the agricultural sanctuary meant that TPP commitments would not bring major disruptions to Japanese farmers, the government allocated generous amount of subsidies as TPP countermeasures, which goes to show that breaking old political habits is hard. Once more, the government sought to appease farmers with subsidies that do little to modernize Japanese agriculture. In the 2015 supplementary budget, one-third of the funds were allocated to public works. Again, the old inertias were back. But nevertheless, we should not lose sight of the fact that change has indeed happened. The agricultural lobby can no longer prevent Japan from negotiating with its main trading partners. And the irony is that as Japan was able to overcome its own hurdles to join TPP and make enough concessions to strike its most ambitious trade deal to date, the new American administration decided to walk from the agreement. And then this brings me to the third dilemma that I would like to highlight for all of you. That concerns the United States in its attempt, I wish, to renew internationalism. The unprecedented trade backlash in the 2016 presidential election was years in the making. American trade policy has suffered from an expanding legitimacy problem, fueled by three central concerns that I spend a lot of time in the book discussing. These concerns are about the distributional consequences of trade liberalization, about the growing reach of trade commitments on the domestic regulatory agenda, and the insufficient representativeness in the formulation of trade policy. This trade legitimacy challenge has been compounded by a broader process of political and economic polarization in the United States, gridlock in Washington, and stress from the continued rise of income inequality, the squeezing of the middle class, and the curtailment of social mobility. With hindsight, it is possible to see that the Obama administration pursued the most ambitious trade strategy in a generation, with mega trade agreements across the Pacific and across the Atlantic in the midst of this sharpening domestic cleavage. And it did so while relying on traditional solutions to the trade governance dilemmas that had long ceased to be effective. No debate has gained more traction in this country than the one about the distributional effects of globalization, how trade agreements impact wages and employment. Recently, the focal point of this discussion has been the so-called China trade shock, defining by a group of economists that imports from China were responsible for up to one-sixth of the manufacturing jobs lost during the 2000s. But it's important to add other data points here. The drop in manufacturing employment is a longer-term historical trend that reflects a structural change in the American economy. Most of the manufacturing jobs lost in the 2000s resulted from technological change. By one estimate, 87% of those losses can be attributed to technological change and automation. And American consumers, especially in the lower tiers of the income ladder, have benefited substantially from access to low-cost products, helping reduce the cost of living. So I would say that it is the other finding of the China trade shock scholarship that is most illuminating, most significant. Displaced workers face a much more difficult and prolonged transition than we had previously reckoned, with long spells of unemployment, wage losses, and the lack of opportunities in depressed communities. There is a major policy failure to correct here. The American solution to the problem of worker adjustment has been the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, which by design and execution has been inadequate in addressing the needs of all workers to gain skills and mobility to cope with a faster pace of economic change. So what are the shortcomings of a Trade Adjustment Assistance Program? First of all, as its name says it, it is only available to a small subset of all American workers, only those as certified as impacted by trade agreements. But we know that, again, technological change, automation, the Internet of Things, robotics, will create even more stress on American workers. And I think all of us saw the big story today in the New York Times about the retail industry. And those realities are with us, and we don't have this set of expanded benefits extended to all American workers. And other aspects of the TAA have been offered just to a subset of workers. Wage insurance, for example, is only available for older workers, and relocation allowances are insufficient to facilitate geographical mobility. So in many ways, the United States has pursued globalization on the cheap, without investing on its workforce, on social mobility. Keep in mind that the United States ranks bottom third among OECD countries in terms of how much it spends on active labor market policies, policies that seek to provide training and re-employment. But my point is that this is not recent. We're living today with the consequences of long-term choices. There's one graph in the book that I think is most eloquent. What that graph does is that it tracks how, over a 40-year span, the United States has deepened its reliance on international trade. It went from 15% of GDP in 1975 to 40% of GDP today. At the same time, in those 40 years, what the United States spends in the safety net is lower today as a share of GDP than what it was in 1975. And for me, this is, of course, a great tragedy, because it means that we have to relearn, and with great urgency, a very old insight in the political economy of trade. And that is that trade liberalization without a safety net is not socially or politically sustainable. And I think then this is where we are today. So how should we move forward? My recommendations fall in two broad areas. First of all, investments at home in human capital and investments abroad on trade and investment rules. So let me just highlight briefly what these recommendations look like. Let me start with the United States to highlight the benefit of investments at home on human capital. The United States is in need of a renewed safety net for displaced workers affected by globalization, by automation, by macroeconomic shocks. The cause of the distress should not matter. It should be guided by two organizing principles. First of all, resilience, fallback programs such as unemployment insurance and affordable healthcare, but also mobility. And that is spring-forward programs that emphasize training and employment. Skill acquisition and upgrading should be at the heart of this strategy, as this is essential to increase employability, avoid wage erosion, and manage relocations across regions, across occupations. But let me turn to what should we do internationally. And this will require, I think, leadership, investments in leadership. The Trump administration has rejected TPP, arguing that multilateral trade agreements do not offer the best deal for the United States and that bilateral negotiations will yield better outcomes. But we should remember that the United States has already tried negotiating bilateral trade agreements, and the limits of this strategy are also known to us. Negotiating one-on-one will take a long time, putting the United States behind, and it's unlikely this will yield better outcomes because you're in effect giving up on the opportunity of opening several markets at one time, having coherent rules across different countries, and many of our counterparts will be more willing to make more concessions if they expect larger payoffs from bigger trade deals. Exit from the TPP will be costly for the United States. American producers will be disadvantaged because they do not enjoy preferential market access like their competitors. And these effects are already being felt. For example, Australian beef producers enjoy better terms of access to the Japanese market because there is an Australia-Japan free trade agreement. In foregoing TPP, the United States has also ditched a rulebook that helps disseminate disciplines useful in addressing problematic Chinese trade and investment practices that would go at addressing issues such as the asymmetric reciprocity on foreign direct investment or the rampant subsidization of state-owned enterprises. And the geopolitical fallout is also large. What we're witnessing today is that trade is increasingly becoming a wedge issue between the United States and its closest partners. And also that China has been given an opportunity to draw a contrast between a retreating United States and its stepped-up multilateral diplomacy in a wide array of policy arenas, including trade. The American withdrawal from the TPP is also a major blow for Japan, given the centrality of the trade deal to Japan's economic revitalization strategy and its foreign policy. But salvaging what remains of the TPP is in Japan's national interest. It helps Japan fight the tide of rising economic nationalism. It preserves a rulebook that enhances the operation of Japanese supply chains, which are critical to Japan's prosperity, given demographic trends that will result in a drop in population levels. Japan needs to remain vitally connected to overseas markets. And it also helps Japan have a horse in the race regionally to define the terms of economic integration so that China does not become the only focal point of such efforts. It also helps Japan encourage a potential return of the United States to trade multilateralism. Of course, this will not happen soon. And of course, it will not happen unless the United States addresses its own domestic challenges, like the ones I discussed earlier. But if the hope is to bring back the United States to the regional architecture, it will be much easier to accomplish that goal by keeping the TPP project alive, because the United States will be able to find its way back to a trade agreement that very much was originally shaped by the United States. It followed its own template regarding trade and investment rules. Giving the TPP a new lease on life is a tall order. It will demand heavy doses of political capital and creative diplomacy, especially to encourage other TPP countries still on the fence to stay on board. But if it happens, Japan, as the largest remaining economy in this TPP 11, is, of course, of critical importance. And Japan actually can tap on its broader array of tools to try to persuade these countries to stay on board. Use economic assistance, for example, to help Vietnam implement its TPP commitments. So this is, I think, the latest turn in a book constantly having to adapt to fast-changing reality. In a way, it means coming full circle. I was originally motivated by the question of whether Japan can provide trade leadership, and the survival of TPP may be the most important test of that proposition. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed the discussion of Maria's book, and I have to say I'm truly honored to be invited to be the discussant of the book today. I've been a longtime admirer of Maria and her work, and this book only reinforces my view. Now, Richard mentioned it was a great cover. I can say the contents are great, too, but I do like the cover. It's really a rich book on the challenges and dilemmas facing trade policy. I expected a book really just on the U.S. and Japan. And when I was reading through this book, the book goes way beyond that by explaining the evolution of trade policy, how and why trade agreements have taken on all of these other issues, the importance of transparency and central decision-making in trade negotiations, and the need for what Maria calls complementary domestic measures, which I agree with her are critical if we're going to go forward on trade liberalization. Maria said the ground shifted as she was writing the book, and I feel her pain. There are a lot of people in Washington where we were working on a lot of different projects and reports at that time, and we kind of had to regroup and recalibrate. But I think she did a great job in doing that and capturing the sentiments in both the U.S. and Japan at a time when trade history is still being written. Now, I pride myself on knowing a lot about trade, having lived and breathed it at USTR for almost 30 years, but it became evident as I read this book on how much more there is to learn and how much more to reflect on. And she skillfully provides background and perspectives on important developments, some developments in the negotiations I have put in the back of my mind. And she summarizes and critiques key findings of economists and offers recommendations for moving forward. I thought what I would just do in the next 10 minutes is really touch upon three areas of the book and offer my observations, the first being on the evolution of the U.S. and Japan trade ties, focus on TPP. Second, the importance of transparency in trade negotiations. And third, on the need for effective and responsive domestic policies to accompany trade agreements. The book underscores a major irony in U.S.-Japan trade relations. We are both now at important junctures in our trade policies, just not in the positions that anyone would have predicted just a few years ago. For Japan, having taken on its agriculture vested interests, having negotiated a comprehensive TPP agreement with 11 other countries, and then secured Diet approval, Japan now seems poised to making TPP 11 a reality. And I always know Japan's serious about something when it gives something a nickname, and Abe is calling the TPP 11 now Oceans 11. Conversely, the U.S., we've exited TPP. We've stepped back from leading plurilateral negotiations in Geneva, and we're now focusing on reducing bilateral trade deficits with individual trading partners. In short, we're pursuing a more inward-looking trade policy, vacating our historical leadership position. And at the same time, Maria notes the similar challenges that both the U.S. and Japan face, including addressing domestic political hurdles, the need to address competitiveness challenges, whether it's infrastructure for the U.S. or agriculture reform for Japan, and the importance of implementing effective adjustment for those left behind by trade and globalization. The book does an incredible job in detailing the series of constraints that Japanese trade policy has faced over the years, and notably the unwillingness to move on agriculture as a result of strong vested interest, coupled with a system of decentralized negotiating authority, which made a proactive trade policy virtually impossible. Negotiating with Japan presented its challenges through the years. I experienced a lot of those challenges, negotiating with different ministries, often leading to the lowest common denominator approach from the Japanese side, and different voices leading to confusion on who was calling the shots. But this changed with TPP, which is a major turning point for Japan. The book offers valid reasons for this transformation, but one area did not play up that I believe was important in this transformation was CORUS, and it's not because I was the lead negotiator for that agreement. In many respects, the U.S.-Korea FTA was a wake-up call for Japan, because if Korea could take on its vested agricultural interests, why couldn't Japan? As Maria mentioned, the DPJ started the TPP debate, but Abe and the LDP brought it over the finish line. The DPJ certainly had its leadership challenges, having about three prime ministers in less than 2 years. But I believe when the DPJ laid important groundwork in the Japanese society, which really paved the way for Abe to embrace TPP. Because it was during the DPJ's reign when active debate on TPP took place, with unfounded rumors, and some of these I look back on and I can't even believe that I was there debating these issues. One was that the TPP was going to require that everyone in Japan speak English in school. There was one that we were going to force Japan to adopt our healthcare system. Don't think that was right. And finally, that all food safety measures in Japan would go by the wayside. I think Maria brings back that term TPP ghosts. I kind of remember that term, kind of way in the back of my mind, but it certainly wasn't a bright spot. But it did pave the way for Prime Minister Abe to announce the readiness of Japan to enter TPP in March of 2013. Everyone thought then he was going to wait until the summer past the upper house elections, but he surprised everyone, and he announced it, and he put together an incredible team. He followed some advice, and that was to really have a centralized negotiating authority, and he did that with the Minister Amari at the TPP headquarters in the Cabinet Office, and he really put in place a first-rate team. And in TPP, Japan took a new negotiating posture. They were still tough, but they learned to take the lead. They learned how to put forward proposals, reaching compromises, and to work with other countries to bring them on board. They had an offensive agenda, and they were not just driven by their defensive agricultural concerns. But as Maria pointed out, this didn't mean that they didn't work hard to do as little as possible on agriculture. And as her book points out, and Maria, I think Maria just mentioned, of all the TPP countries, Japan's liberalization rate in agriculture is the lowest. But now we're in a new stage with the US TPP exit and the leadership vacuum. TPP 11 has become much more of a reality with Japan now buying into this and showing leadership. In fact, Japan will be hosting a meeting of the TPP officials, it's still June, next month in July. The playbook's still being written on whether they can lead TPP 11 to successful conclusion. At the same time, the U.S. is retreating. Once again, we're pursuing bilateral FTAs over multilateral ones and pursuing other policies as well. But just to bring home what different places we're at, let's just look at the next 2 weeks on the trade front. For the U.S., we're expecting to issue our trade deficit report on 16 trade deficit countries. And there's talk of the U.S. announcing its findings on the Steel 232 investigation. And perhaps we may again take on G20 countries next weekend on the trade language in the communique. And for Japan, we're seeing very different things. They're close, if not already, finalized a market opening deal with the EU. We'll have to see the role they play in the G20 deliberations. And once again, they will be hosting the meeting of the TPP 11 in a week or so. Before leaving this subject, I just want to raise one other difference between the US and Japan right now. As Japan trade policy becomes more centralized, in the US, we're seeing a number of power centers on trade, including the Commerce Secretary, the USTR, the head of the NEC, Peter Navarro, and the president himself. And my humble recommendation to our team is that based on my experience, it's really important to sort this out before trade negotiations with our NAFTA partners are launched, so our trading partners have one point of contact. Let me then briefly turn just to two other points I wanted to touch upon as I discuss Maria's book, and that is the issue of transparency in trade negotiations. I believe this is going to be a major challenge going forward. And I note that this issue was already raised with Ambassador Lighthizer last week when he testified. Here, we're trying to balance the need for confidentiality in negotiations with other countries with the need to provide detailed information to the public on talks that matter to Americans. And with millennials and the digital age, expectations grow for more and more transparency. There were a lot of critics of TPP transparency in the US. There were some that believed that this was an easy way for folks, an easy issue for folks to identify with during the talks. It was harder to discuss the details of the negotiations, so let's just call these negotiations secret and criticize them. However, this is a real issue, and the administration, the previous administration, tried to address this issue, but clearly didn't go far enough. And so this is an issue that I think we're going to have to deal with going forward. Maria's book proposes and cites some interesting recommendations and suggestions in this area, and I would encourage everyone to read that chapter closely, because I think this is an issue that's not going to go away. It's only going to become more prevalent. And speaking of more prevalent, let me just conclude and say these complementary domestic measures are going to be critical for going forward in the U.S. and other countries on trade liberalization. As Maria mentioned, trade policy is an integral component, but not a substitute for overarching competitiveness strategy, for the social safety net, for matching education with next generation skills. This means that the U.S. needs to build out its infrastructure. It means Japan needs to modernize its agriculture. But there are other structural reforms that are needed as well. The IMF, for example, just this week highlighted the need for Japan to pursue major labor reform, including narrowing the gap between regular and non-regular workers. And the U.S. needs to narrow the income equality gap that's growing in our country. And on adjustment, I mean, Maria couldn't have been more spot on, and that is adjustment in the United States has really been tied to trade. And there's a bar there to get trade adjustment assistance. You need to show that you're losing your job due to trade. But in reality, when you look at the statistics, everything suggests that it's technological advances, increases in productivity and automation, which are more responsible for the loss of jobs and low-paying jobs. And therefore, our whole concept of adjustment needs to be expanded and deepened. One concluding comment, and that has to do with Maria's last recommendation, that internationally, we, meaning the U.S. and Japan, uphold free trade and multilateral governance. Pre-Trump administration, I think this was the natural path forward for the U.S. and Japan to lead, and when TPP was concluded, that's indeed what we were talking about. We had a strong convergence of interest, both bilaterally, regionally, and globally. But that's not the case now. U.S. trade policy, for at least now, is based on America first, and we're no longer as interested in helping to set the standards and rules for the international trading system. And that, in my conclusion, brings me back to Japan, and all eyes are on Japan now. Japan has an incredible opportunity to fill the void that we've created and pursue a proactive trade policy and exercise leadership. Will it be able and willing to seize the opportunity? I hope so. Thank you.
In order to fulfill my obligation as moderator, I was busy writing down questions as Maria and Wendy were speaking. But then every one of the things that I had in mind, they addressed. So I'm left with nothing. So I have to depend on you, the audience, to make up for my deficiencies. But there are a lot of smart people in the audience, so I'm sure that you will. So what I would ask is that you, if you want to ask a question, wait to be recognized, wait for the mic, tell us who you are, where you're from, and as you can tell, both Maria and Wendy are very smart, so you can keep your question simple, and I'm sure you'll get a full answer. So who'd like to go first? Right here. Okay. Wait just a second. Mic is coming.
Hey, thank you very much for coming. Good afternoon. My name is Julian Kyle Lewis. I study international education policy at the American University here in D.C. When President Trump first had an official meeting with the president of China, the Chinese president went back and told his nation that he had to spend 20 minutes giving our president a brief rundown of the historical diplomatic actions in China and East Asia, and just a whole policy rundown. And he actually gave a revisionist history version to our president by stating that China ruled Korea at one time, which is not accurate. But what President Trump did was go back in a press conference and tell the whole world that as though it were the truth. And now our media has really gotten on him about that. And Taiwan needs military funding from us, and they're pulling back now. And South Korea has now taken down their missile defense, right? Their missile defense from North Korea in response to these kinds of statements. I'm wondering, from Japan's perspective as one of our allies, how is that being received diplomatically in Japan? Thank you very much.
The Trump presidency has brought about, I think, major recalibration in the strategy of Asian countries. And Japan, I would say, has been very skillful in the way it has adjusted to the new situation. From the get-go, the strategy was to try to develop a close relationship with President Trump precisely because of the added benefits of bringing to him the regional issues and explaining to him from the point of view of Japan what was essential, what was critical, and also out of the understanding that good personal chemistry between the two leaders might be very beneficial in this kind of administration. So I think that, you know, the first the second meeting between President Trump and Prime Minister Abe on the security front delivered everything that Japan may have wanted in terms of very strong reiteration of the U.S. commitment to Japan's security. And I think that there was also the very smart decision to not have the two leaders discuss directly the economic agenda, because that is when the potential difference of opinion may emerge. That's why the decision was to launch the ASO-PENS dialogue. The first meeting has already taken place, but nothing concrete has come out of it, and I think that that is because, as Wendy was saying in his remarks, there is now a very substantial divergence in terms of what these two governments see as driving trade, the nature of trade relations, and what is the best way to move forward. Japan's still making the case for TPP. It's talking about rulemaking, whereas the Trump administration is talking about a string of bilaterals with the notion that you could use trade rules to erase trade deficits, regardless of the larger macroeconomic forces at work.
Have a comment, Wendy? Okay, another question. Let's go over here first, and then I'll come here. A little further back.
Hi, my name is Mike Muller. I'm from the Heritage Foundation. One of my questions was, how does the United States leaving the TPP affect the geopolitical interest of in the region?
Well, where to start, I guess, is the question. I mean, I think essentially it leaves a huge vacuum in the region, and countries are now engaged in hedging. And this has also created an opportunity, as I said before, for China to make a more persuasive case that is prepared to champion multilateral initiatives, and for countries to doubt the commitment of the United States. I mean, let's not forget that many of these TPP countries made very painful concessions as part of the negotiations, because they were expecting not only the economic benefits, but the reassurance of the United States presence in the region. When the United States organized a major pivot away, then that hurts the credibility of the U.S. Presence in the region. And we begin to see then these developments. We begin to see that Japan pursues now TPP 11. It's about to close Japan-EU, but also the RCEP now has received the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. Those negotiations have intensified as well. And then you think about the other set of initiatives that China is pursuing, the Belt Road Initiative, the IB, and an image begins to form that the United States does not have its act together, does not really know what it wants to do in terms of its trade strategy, is willing to walk away from major trade negotiations while China keeps on the march with these initiatives.
Gentleman right here, and I'll come to you. And then...
Thank you. John Mullen, McClarty Associates and Georgetown University. I understand why Japan now favors the TPP 11. Initially, they did not. Uh-huh. And I wonder if you could walk through what changed their minds politically and economically, if you will. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your question. I think nobody forgets that statement of Prime Minister Abe that TPP without the United States was meaningless. And I have to say that I was in Tokyo maybe a couple of days after the election. And I remember making the rounds with, Japanese officials. And, I had just written a piece TPP 11 is the way to go for Japan, and I was not finding traction. I was struggling. I was pitching them the idea in some ways, and I think it had to do, first of all, the idea that, you know, what it said in the campaign trail is not necessarily what, you know, governments do, so that there could be some adjustment. But I was telling you, this is not an ordinary administration, the one that's coming in. And these are a set of ideas that have been very fixed in the mind of the now new president for three decades. And many of his close advisors on trade are, you know, very much along the same line. So I couldn't see a major correction course. I think that one very important element for Japan to be able to execute that change was to get some reading that the United States would not react very negatively towards Japan moving on with the TPP 11. And so we had a number of Japanese Diet members come to Washington. I think that they heard from people in Congress that encouraged Japan to take on the mantle of promoting free trade, and that gave him the assurance that maybe this was the right thing to do. It wouldn't damage U.S.-Japan relations. And I also think now that the U.S. is talking about a bilateral Japan-U.S. trade agreement, having TPP as a live possibility also gives Japan some bargaining power in that potential negotiation.
Wendy, did you have anything?
Nothing to add.
Could I ask about TPP 11? Mm-hmm. What's the risk that if you move towards that and make the adjustments necessary in the text, that the whole text gets opened up and the thing collapses of its own weight?
Thank you, Richard. No, that's a very important question. I mean, there are different approaches of how you actually make TPP 11 happen. The easiest change would just be to change that clause about the critical mass required for the TPP to enter into force, because the way it's written today cannot enter into force without the United States. We just don't meet that bar. So you could argue, well, then let's just change that one clause and everything will be fine. And some TPP countries are closer to that position, but others, especially Malaysia and Vietnam, feel that, you know, the deal has to be recalibrated because they did agree to many sensitive concessions because they were expecting a major economic benefits from preferential access to the United States. And once you take that off the table, they argue they gave too much. It does not justify the extent of the concession. But as you were hinting in your question, Richard, there's nothing like a surgical renegotiation because everyone, once you open it up, every country is going to want to tinker with it. Everybody has sensitive issues, and the challenge there is that it could unravel, and then you could have a very difficult path forward for TPP. So, you know, I think that really comes down, in my mind, Vietnam is critical to this whole exercise because Vietnam is essential in the sense that it's a Southeast Asian country, it's a country with a very heavy state presence in the economy, and in many ways is a test case for the ability of TPP-like disciplines to tackle state-owned enterprises, to be able to have a bigger projection across Asia. And Vietnam is reluctant. So what we've seen Japan do is step up its diplomacy. You know, there have been a number of meetings. And I think the one concept I have put forward is that Japan could launch something like a TPP readiness initiative. And that is help Vietnam do a gap analysis of what it needs to do to actually meet the TPP commitments and then offer tailored economic development assistance projects that can help Vietnam do this. Japan has a long-term presence in Vietnam, has been a long-time donor to this country, and therefore you do have the institutional structures, you do have that kind of legacy to tap on. And last point, let's not forget that Vietnam actually has already started to move along some of the reforms that were motivated by TPP because Vietnam also has a trade agreement with the European Union that addresses some of these labor issues. And the most far-reaching labor reforms would only come into place if the United States was in TPP as part of that bilateral labor consistency plan. But the United States has stepped out, and therefore the bar for Vietnam might not be as far off as we might imagine to begin with.
Comment?
Yeah, if I can add, I mean, I think concluding a TPP 11 is going to be a big challenge. Mm-hmm. There are just a lot of issues there, and the ability of all 11 to
you know, participate and not to change anything except for the entry into force provisions is a, you know, a big question mark. That said, once Japan changed its tune, I'm much more optimistic that maybe a way forward can be found. Ideally, you would keep everything together and not have each country or certain countries chipping away at certain provisions, because as Maria mentioned, that could just lead to an unraveling. But I think that's exactly what these TPP 11 countries are doing now, trying to figure out, are there different options for going forward? What's interesting for Japan itself, it doesn't want to make any changes to the text because it wants to keep agriculture frozen. And so I think it's a little worried that once you open up certain provisions in TPP 11, that could lead to a reopening of agriculture. But I think these are exactly the issues that the ministers asked the officials to work on between now and the APEC meeting. And these are the issues, you know, that they are looking at in detail. And we'll have to see, you know, how this proceeds. Besides Vietnam and Malaysia, which seem to be have a lot of question marks on this process, or at least trying to figure out how they can go forward without getting U.S. market access, Canada and Mexico also present an interesting question, and that is soon this administration will be embarking on NAFTA renegotiations. And from a negotiating perspective, if Mexico and Canada were to tell the TPP 11 they could go ahead and do everything in the TPP 11, one could argue that could lessen their negotiating leverage in NAFTA renegotiations. So this is a bit complicated, and each country kind of brings their own baggage to the table. But once again, I think there's a huge opportunity here, and I think that if Japan is really committed and ready to show leadership, there's a good chance that this could happen.
The gentleman on the aisle there, the mic is coming.
Tobias Harris, Teneo Intelligence in Sasakawa, USA. Maria, looking forward to the book. I was actually going to ask about Japan vis-a-vis Vietnam because it is, I think, the most important question in the TPP 11 debate. But I guess just looking back from that, and both of you have sounded kind of optimistic notes about Japan as a leader on the, on sort of global trade liberalization, but it's kind of an awkward fit based on the past history. So I guess how durable is this going, especially domestically? I mean, at some point, Abe's not going to be around forever. I mean, who knows when he makes his exit. I mean, already I think in the sort of end stages of the Japan-EU negotiations, you're seeing some renewed pushback from agricultural interests within the LDP. I mean, how much has Japan embracing this sort of new role? I mean, is it a placeholder until the U.S. comes back around, or are we really going to see down the road Japan, you know, really pushing the agenda forward beyond sort of what's already been there on the agenda?
Thank you, Tobias. That's an excellent question. Couple of observations. I think that in this new trade environment, where the United States is positioning itself to play a very different role in trade policy, and is, you know, launching on the notion that, you know, trade deficits is the only thing that matters, and that we're going to negotiate trade agreements that actually cut on that trade deficit. I think that, you know, in that environment, what Japan is doing has more value than ever before. And even if it's just a placeholder, you could argue that there's already value in that, in the sense that we haven't had, if you think about it, an update in trade and investment rules through the WTO in over 2 decades. Only the trade facilitation agreement, but other than that, it has been slow going there. And one of the reasons why trade growth has slowed down is precisely because of the lack of liberalizing initiatives. So, you know, the Japan-EU FTA, if it makes it to the finish line, and ratification on the European side, we know is extremely complicated, so we cannot count on that as a done deal, nevertheless would be significant. Then either TPP 11 or TPP 5 happens, I would agree that in this context, that still has a lot of value. But we cannot assume, if I've learned anything in this book, is never say never, never expect that what now looks like a strong trend may actually continue in the future. you know, I'm exhibit A for having to adjust your expectations. And we do know that, you know, things could change in Japan. More recently, the prime minister has been getting in more trouble because of a number of political scandals that are now making support levels go down. We don't know if this will be just be temporary or this could actually take on a life of its own. We know that the Abe government is also has always decided to use a lot of its political capital for the security agenda, and now might devote that to constitutional reform. So how much does that leave for the economic agenda or not is a question to be had. So would Japan ever go back to this cycle of indecisiveness? It depends. It depends in the, if these political conditions that have allowed the Kante to work the way it has continue. But I do see more pushback in the sense, as I expect, given what I describe in the book, that when you have top-down leadership, there's going to be pushback because there are costs to be had for not having enough inclusion. And we see that, I think, as a theme in the recent discussions about what the Abe Kante has done recently.
There's a gentleman back there who's been very patient. You still have a question? No, further back. Okay, let's go right here to the, yes, right there, yeah.
Good afternoon. My name is Aditya Aswani. I study international relations at Clemson University in South Carolina, and I'm currently interning at Congressman James Clyburn's office. Thank you very much for your talk. My question is, from your studies of agriculture reform in Japan, what lessons can the U.S. draw with regards to its own agricultural interests?
I feel that I should ask Yamashita-san, who is very lucky for me that he's here today. You know, he's one of the top experts on Japanese agriculture. You know, I just have a general comment, and I would encourage you at the end of the event to reach to Yamashita-san. But if anything, what's striking to me is the ability of agriculture to always be very present in the minds of policymakers. They certainly know how to organize well, and it's a very important sector. But when it comes to Japan, I think that the problem is that the policy framework has not been there to actually generate genuine liberalization. And Yamashita-san has identified some of the issues that have been passed over by the Abe administration when it comes to actually promote commercial agriculture, expand the scale of operations, and get to the issue of how you encourage full-time farmers to thrive in Japan.
Okay, let's go right here. And let's take those two questions together.
Thank you, Rita. Rita Chen from the Central News Agency, Taiwan. My first question is that we have heard the Secretary Rose say that the high standard of the TPP will be implied in the bilateral negotiation, the bilateral FTA. I'm just wondering that it's really work for the Americans' best interest in the long term. And then my second question is especially for Wendy, since you have a lot of negotiation experience with a different Asian country. I'm just curious that when you are talking about like the difficult issue, like the agriculture, what's the difference between the your Japanese counterpart and Taiwanese counterpart? Thank you.
Well, they're all difficult.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In their own way.
Hi, Chia Cheng from United Daily News Media from Taiwan. I have a question for all the panelists. So Taiwanese officials said that Taiwan wants to join the TPP-11. What would be the standards to meet, like the requirements for a Japanese-led TPP?
Just first in response to your question, based on all my negotiating experience, I'd say each negotiating partner, they're all difficult in their own way, and they all have their own peculiarities, and you just learn how to kind of work with them and how to move forward. With respect to your question on the TPP rules, yeah, I think that's really interesting now that the administration now is moving towards renegotiating NAFTA. In the middle of July, they'll be presenting their detailed negotiating objectives to Congress in line with Trade Promotion Authority. And there has been talk that we may see a lot of the TPP rules emerge in our negotiating proposals to NAFTA. And that will be very interesting to see. So issues like digital trade or state-owned enterprises, SPS, technical barriers to trade, we may see those rules emerge as positions of this administration. And I think that attests to the strength and the importance of the TPP rules. But I suspect we're going to see more than just TPP rules in the NAFTA renegotiation based on statements made to date.
I would add to that that when we think about how the TPP project may have an afterlife. We've been discussing TPP 11, but in other ways, what has been highlighted now, that because these rules do tap on areas where the United States is very competitive, it's in the interest of the United States to disseminate these rules, we can expect that they'll be brought up in these other negotiation setups. Having said that, I think it's also important to make the point that it has also been hinted by the administration that because NAFTA, because Mexico and Canada already agreed to these rules, they'll be, you know, taken for granted, automatically brought in, and Canada and Mexico then will only discuss the other issues that the administration is bringing. And I think that Mexican trade negotiators have already put that assumption to rest and have said that this is a new negotiation and will agree to those rules as part of the give and take that comes. Nothing is just grandfathered, and they're not going to lose advantage that way. On how Japan may think about Taiwan at TPP 11, I would say that first we would need to see what is the contour of a TPP 11 to see if there is indeed changes in the rules or not, and then it would be, I would be in better position to address that question. So it's a little bit premature yet to know.
I would add on that, you know, it's interesting when the TPP 11 process first started, it started in Chile, and the Chileans not only invited the TPP 11 countries, but they also invited China and Korea to join that discussion. But since that time, my understanding is the TPP 11 have kind of, at least for now, they're not interested in others joining. They're trying to figure out between the 11 how they can move forward. So we'll have to see how that plays out. The other point I would just raise about TPP 11 that I find so fascinating is that everyone, you know, particularly the press, would love to just say, you know, it's the U.S.-led TPP versus the China-led RCEP. And how interesting if it's a U.S.-led TPP and everyone viewed the TPP like that, and now we have the TPP possibly going forward without the United States. I think that's a testament that it wasn't just a U.S.-led initiative. Maybe the U.S. showed leadership, but it was a real partnership with the 11 other countries that really wanted to pursue a high standards regional agreement.
Question here in the front, and then I'll go back.
Atsushi Yamakoshi from Keidan USA. Maria, thank you very much for your very informative presentation, and Wendy, thank you very much for your very instructive comments. And my question is kind of a fundamental one. Particularly these days, I cannot help feeling gap between discussion here and the response of White House. So I just wondered how effectively can you fill the gap, or how effectively can you convey your message created here to White House? Thank you.
Well, that is a fundamental question that I do feel every day. And I think 2 points. One is, as Wendy was saying, I don't see a unified vision in the White House. And I think that there are some people that may be more amenable to the kinds of arguments and proposals I'm making in the book than others. But I also think it will be a question of time. I think that already the way in which TPP was discussed by some of President Trump's advisors during the campaign trail and early on in the administration was all critical. And I think that we're seeing that as time goes by, they are in many ways rediscovering the benefits of many of these rules. And I also think we need to wait for the reality check that comes when they actually sit at the first negotiation table. This is going to be NAFTA. And they have to then find workable compromises with their partners, because trade negotiations are not impositions. They reflect a mutual give and take. So, again, one of the things that I've learned in writing this book is that you wait also, because things turn to work in cycles. And this is not to take from the fact that I do see there's been a profound transformation in this country, that there are many source of stress that need to be addressed, but I do think that as time goes by, we might see some changes in the way in which the TPP components are viewed by the current administration.
I would also say that it's important at a fairly basic level to fight against particular lines of argument that we have seen over the last year or two. One line of argument is that
Trade barriers are the biggest cause of trade deficits. And if you only remove the trade barriers, the deficits will go down. Well, we understand that's not true, but we need to keep saying it. We need to explain why. It's complicated, but we need to make that argument. Second is that the reason for the economic difficulties of some American citizens is because of trade agreements and globalization. Well, as we've heard, globalization is not blameless here, but it's not the principal cause. And the cause is very much the success of our own economy and the increases in total factor productivity and so on and so on. But, you know, we can't concede the argument to people who don't know what they're talking about. Gentleman on the fourth row, and then we'll come here to Mr. Yamashita.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask a question. My name is Al Madison, and I represent the Japanese steel industry in the United States. So I wanted to veer away from TPP for a moment, and Ms. Cutler referenced 232 as a perhaps the next big trade discussion point, and wonder if anyone on the panel has any thoughts or speculation as to how the administration is pursuing this, and there's a lot of discussion about maybe there's pushback. Any insights that you might have as to how this all might turn out, whether it was cooked from the beginning, or what we might expect to hear in the coming days or weeks.
Let me respond, though, in a broader way, and that is, let me just remind the audience, Section 232 of the 1962 Trade Act is a statute that allows the president to restrict imports based on national security grounds. Its statute's been in effect 55 years. My understanding, it's only been actually used twice, both times with respect to petroleum imports. The last investigation was conducted in 2001 on steel imports at that time under President Bush, and it was determined that there weren't the grounds to restrict trade. There's a lot of concern. A lot of people are watching this, not just the Japan Steel Association, but a lot of our trading partners and other industries in the United States are watching this decision very, very carefully. And there are a number of concerns. One of them is there are a lot of companies that use steel, and to the extent that high import restrictions are put on steel imports, that will lead to higher prices for the inputs for companies that use steel, like our auto companies, which could lead to higher prices for consumers, and could also make our exports less competitive. It's also kind of an unspoken rule in the trade world to use the national security exception very judiciously, because it's something that has never been litigated in the WTO. There is a national security exception, but no one really wants the WTO to rule on whether a country is actually acting in accordance with its national security. So people who are very concerned about the system and the vitality of the WTO are also worried about the determination here. I don't have any insights into where this stands. I know the Secretary of Commerce has said that they're trying to move this decision quickly, maybe by the end of this month. But there's also reports that, you know, others have come in and expressed concerns. A hearing was held. A lot of public comments were submitted. And so I'm hopeful that the administration will make, you know, a very careful, judicious decision here on this case.
Right here.
I'm Yamashita, the Kano Institute for Global Studies. I used to work for the Japanese government, the Ministry of Agriculture, for 30 years. And I just want to make one comment and one question. My comment is about Vietnam. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the TPP-11 negotiations, Vietnam was one of the obstacles. But actually, Vietnam changed its mind And it, now Vietnam is willing to take part in the TPP-11 negotiations. That's partly because if we give some other countries, such as Australia and Canada and Vietnam and other countries, some preferential tariff concessions to the to those countries, then the United States agriculture products, such as beef, wheat, and dairy products, would be completely wiped out in the Japanese market. And take that into consideration, then the United States might come back, not in the Trump administration, but in the other administration, might come back to the Japanese market. In order to do so, the United States might come back to the TPP-11. So that is a new accession negotiation for the United States to TPP-11 agreements. So that's my comment. And my question is that when it comes to the free trade agreements or free trade negotiation, we already talk about agriculture and manufacturing. But actually, when it comes to the share of GDP, agriculture is 1% in the United States, and manufacturing 10%. And in Japan, agriculture 1%, and manufacturing, I think, 60% or 70%. And why don't we talk about the financial sector or service sector, which consists of much larger share of the GDP when we talk about the free trade agreements? So that's my question.
Very good comments, Yamashita-san. Regarding the point you made first on whether the United States would eventually seek its way back to TPP and whether that would open an opportunity for an accession negotiation, that's interesting because there is that position that this would be if the United States left, well, maybe many countries were not entirely happy with the deal and maybe they'll try to rebalance some of those concessions. But I think this is where, it's not just commercial strategy, but it's national security strategy. And my impression in talking with some officials in Tokyo, and I'd be curious what you are hearing as well, is that there is a attempt to leave a placeholder for the United States because it's so important for the United States to be back. And there's an understanding that if you, on top of that, given the fragile situation in this country in terms of the domestic political system delivering on landmark trade agreements, that may actually, again, be another hurdle. And at the end of the day, this was a sufficiently good enough deal for Japan commercially, and it's certainly important geopolitically to bring back the United States. So they may give it a pass, even though I think that the instinct as a trade negotiator would be to say, no, wait, I mean, if they want back, they should pay an admission ticket. So that's, I think, an interesting possibility into the future, not immediate, but maybe further off. And, I agree that we tend to discuss the tangibles and not the intangibles whenever we focus on trade policy. But this, again, is the value of the TPP is that, for the first time you have rules on the digital economy, further liberalization of services. This is one area where, again, it's not highlighted enough that Japan has many sectors where it has lagged in the internationalization of these sectors. And with services in TPP, it actually went further than it has ever before. So I don't know if it's because in our gut we're still, 20th century mercantilists, that we still just think about its rise for autos, but we should not lose sight of the fact that the economy is far more complex than that, and these trade agreements have evolved for that reason.
I could just add one thing to the first point, and that is if you look at the statement that the TPP-11 issued the last time they met on the margins of the Vietnam APEC meeting, they specifically have language that kind of recognizes the need to kind of facilitate the re-entry by the original members, which I interpret to mean that they're not contemplating a tough accession negotiation. If the U.S. wants to come back, my sense is the doors will be wide open.
Okay, I think we're out of time. I'm sorry for those whom I didn't have a chance to recognize. I want to thank all of you for coming. I particularly want to thank our speakers, but hold your applause until I'm finished. First of all, I'd like to thank Maria for doing the book, and please buy the book. It's easy. But I'd also like to thank you for the way in which you have enriched the discussion of Japan here at Brookings and in Washington, D.C. It's very important. Second, thank you, Wendy, for being a commentator, but also thank you for working three decades in the trenches to expand and improve the international trading system. Thanks.